Here ends the satsang session of 13th June 1985. Beginning now the satsang session of 16th June 1985.
We started the fourth canto of the third book in our last session. And we noted how, as Ashwapati was waiting in tranced prayer, there was a stir and he heard in the listening spaces of his soul the loud footfalls of her for whom he was waiting. She envelops him and he begins to hear her words from within his heart. We noted that contrary to the picturizations which are popular, she is not there somewhere above and he at her feet below, but she has enveloped him entirely and she is speaking from the depths of his heart. She has heard his prayer. She tells him that he has won a great victory, but he has to keep it for himself. She asks him not to be impatient, but to leave things to wise nature, because, she says, truth born too soon might break the imperfect earth. She also tells him that he cannot retire, brook in repose, when death is still unconquered in the field of time. She told him, thy soul was born to share the laden force, accept the difficulty and godlike toil, for the slow-paced omniscient purpose live. And then she speaks how the human is the knot where the higher and the lower join, where the solution of the paradox lies in man, says, the enigma's knot is tied in humankind. He is the problem, the problem of existence, the contrariety between spirit and matter, joy and pain, that can be resolved only in the being of man. For the knot has formed and is projected in the humankind. She speaks further of man. What is man? A lightning from the heights that think and plan, plowing the air of life with vanishing trails. Man, soul awake in an unconscious world, aspires in vain to change the cosmic dream. Man is like a lightning, a sharp lightning, a ray of light, a piercing ray that comes from those supernal heights that think and plan to execute what is thought. And that lightning courses through the air of life, leaving with its trails vanishing moment to moment. And he is the sole creature who is awake in an unconscious world. Because though we say there is a consciousness in plants, in animals, in stone, they are not awake in the sense that they are not self-aware. Man is the first creature to be self-aware, and that is his superiority. So he says, soul awake in an unconscious world aspires in vain to change the cosmic dream. The whole cosmic life is compared to a dream, and man hopes in vain to change it, because he has the inherent aspiration and hope to change the whole disposition of life. Arrived from some half-luminous beyond, he is a stranger in the mindless wastes. Here, in the wastes of creation, which are not governed by the mind, even lower than the mind, he is someone who has arrived from the beyond, which appears only half-luminous. A traveller in his oft-shifting home. Now he bases himself in one status. After a while he moves on. So his home is something changing. He doesn't have a stable home, a stable base, because he functions in life, the chief characteristic of which is flowing like a stream. A traveller in his oft-shifting home, amid the tread of many infinitudes. Now here is a key idea of Sri Aurobindo's philosophy, that on every plane in creation there is an interchange, an interaction from every other plane. The infinitudes of the higher planes of the Parartha, they have a constant action even on the lower planes of matter, life and mind. All these seven planes of existence are interacting. Not only are the seven planes present in principle on every plane, but there is a living action, an interchange, and what is more important, a perception which is shared only by some old occult traditions, is there is not only a pressure on earth from the higher planes, but even from below, even from the earth, a pressure is exerted on the highest planes by a concentrated consciousness of an individual. A person who has arrived at a certain maturity of consciousness can exert a pull by his aspiration, by his prayer, on the highest plane, not to speak of the intermediate planes, to have some effect here. And it is in this context that you have to understand Mother or Sri Aurobindo pulling, linking themselves to the supermind and pulling it below. So, descent, yes, but the descent is provoked by an ascent. The initiating movement is the ascent. The responding movement is the descent. So he says, amid the tread of many infinitudes, above are all infinities, and they are constantly treading this soil of earth, whether we are aware of it or not. We get brief glimpses in our best dreams. Such a man, such a traveler, he has pitched the tent of life in desert space, coming from that luminous beyond. This space on earth, in this field of ignorance, looks like a desert, and there he has pitched his tent, obviously for a certain purpose. And he is not alone. He is a voyager. He has pitched his house is constantly shifting. He has pitched his tent in a desert called space. And heaven's fixed regard beholds him from above. There is a constant, sanctioning, supportive regard of heaven on man working below. That is, the divine grace, the divine eye is always overseeing the effort of man and helping it to fructify. Heaven's fixed regard beholds him from above, in the house of nature a perturbing guest. Man is a guest in this house of nature, and he is a perturbing guest, not a very welcome guest who fits in and settles down in the house of nature. But he upsets everything. He perturbs the fixed order of nature by his aspiration, by the movement of change that he initiates. He precipitates the moment of change. And that is why he is described as a perturbing guest, a voyager twixt thoughts in constant shores. Thought is never constant. Today it has a regard on something, tomorrow something else. So it is always moving from shores which are constantly changing. In between is man, this traveler. Because thought is not fixed. Thought is a moving factor. A hunter of unknown and beautiful powers, man is not satisfied with his present life. He is not content with what he knows, but he is a search for higher powers which may be unknown, but they are beautiful. The powers with which he is familiar are maybe powerful but crude, but he knows instinctively that there are more beautiful powers. And he is searching for them, a nomad of the far mysterious light. A nomad is one who doesn't have a fixed home, always moving from tent to tent, from place to place. And he comes from the land of that light which is far and mysterious. In the wide ways, a little spark of God. In all these vastitudes, in the wide ways of the universe, he is there moving, a little spark of God. That is why he is not extinguished. He cannot die forever. Because he is a spark of God, who is immortal, who is eternal. Against his spirit, all is in dire league. Against the spirit of conquest, the spirit of adventure of man, everything is in organized opposition, league, dire league, that there is an understanding between the various antagonistic elements to oppose man in his push towards change, in his push towards adventure, upwards. Against his spirit, all is in dire league. A titan influence stops his godward gaze. He man gazes upward. Earlier, Sri Aurobindo has described how man, when after the arrival of man, he lifts his regard to look at his companion stars. He is the first creature on earth to look upwards to the skies. Till he arrives, all creatures have their heads and eyes and nose bent downwards. He is the first one who has that vertebral constitution, he stands upwards and he sees at the companion stars. So he says, his godward gaze, but there is a titan influence, an asuric influence, which wants to interrupt, which wants to shut off the higher truth from even the gaze of man by creating confusion, by distracting his attention. Around him hungers the unpitying void, the void where there is no overt consciousness yet. It wants to swallow him up. It has no pity, and its hunger is insatiable. The eternal darkness seeks him with her hands. Darkness is put capital to show that it is a cosmic phenomenon, not something individual. But just as there is a divinity, a cosmic divinity, there is also opposing it, a cosmic darkness. The fact that the darkness itself is only a disfiguration of an original light is another truth, which he touches upon in another place. But here he describes it as the eternal darkness seeks him with her hands, wants to blind him, wants to possess him, wants to twist his vision. And inscrutable energies drive him and deceive. The vital forces, the vital energies, desire, based on desire, motivated by ego, they drive him where they choose and deceive him. Immense, implacable deities oppose. Implacable, those which cannot be satisfied, those which cannot be pleased. Deities oppose, that is, the opposition comes. Opposition to the supreme manifestation comes not only from the titanic influences, but even from an order of deities, what we call in the tantras the kshudra devatas, not the uchcha devatas, but the kshudra devatas, which love to hold man in their dominion. They will give him whatever he wants, whatever he asks, provided he is content to stay as their creature. They will oppose his advance beyond their kingdom. So these are the implacable deities, immense deities. They have got immense empires. They are the deities whom most people worship as Grama Devatas, and you know, to whom the animals are sacrificed, and that sort of thing, the primitive religion worships these deities, and these deities oppose advance of man beyond them. You would remember mother describing how when she went to a village nearby, Ariyamkuppam, she saw when she approached that village a very dark formation. Just then, it was a festival day, and number of chicken had been killed and all their feathers had been lying around. But you know, mother did not turn away in disgust. She was always very curious about these things. So she wanted to know what is it all about. So she went ahead. At that time the ashram was quite small, and Pavitra was driving the car. It is a small car, and they went. And then she saw that there was a particular deity. I suppose it was called Kali or some local name, I don't remember. And she approached mother, of course in the supraphysical or the occult plane, and she said, let us have an understanding that you allow me to function here and I will not stand in your way or something like that. Mother didn't reply, mother didn't answer. But many such instances have happened. When mother had gone to neighboring villages, when these implacable deities have proposed pacts with her, and she had her own way of working, it was never to compromise, never to have a pact. Just as she describes how, when one Durgashtami day, at that time, she used to come down with a particular red sari and a crown to give blessings, because people wanted her to bless them on Mahalakshmi Day and Durgashtami. And usually she said that Durga would be present in the atmosphere 1 or 2 days earlier. Now, a couple of years before, 2 or 3 years before she left, when Durga appeared, and just at that time there was in Auroville a movement that some people wanted to organize a worship of Durga as to make puja. They had been a sort of initiated by a tantric guru from the south, some foreigners. And they were, as usual, over enthusiastic, and they wanted to perform the puja of that Durga. They have an image, or there was already an image in stone, they wanted to do that. Just then some other Aurovillians, one of them was a former Christian priest, he said, if you do that, I will have my mass, like a church, I will hold a mass. If mother has said there is no religion, if you have import religion, I will import mine. So somehow they spoke to me and they asked me to ask mother. So when I asked mother, so mother told me this story. She said, it is curious. So yesterday or something like, day before yesterday, she said Durga was there. And she came before mother. And mother asked her, why do you want to be worshipped? So Durga looked quizzically at mother. What shall I do? Mother said, surrender to the Lord, Supreme Lord. And mother says, she accepted. So she said, hereafter there is no question of worshipping Durga. She has surrendered to the Divine Supreme. And that's the message I was asked to tell the people. And there were no festivities. But this, even a deity like Durga. But a popular conception of these deities is different from the original deities. In the Devi Mahatmya or the Chandi, for instance, you see that Durga is a direct emanation from the Supreme Divine Mother. She is an emanation. Always having connection, put out for a particular purpose. But the popular Durga, popular Kali, which we ignorant humans worship in our own ignorant way. They are smaller beings carrying the name of the bigger, higher deities. They call themselves Durga, they call themselves Kali. Mother was very definite that the Kali, which is being worshipped in Kali Ghat today, is not the original Kali who appeared to Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. She was quite different. Mother says that Kali is beautiful. She doesn't have all these skulls around her neck, but it is a symbolic way of representing her function on the physical plane, that she kills evil. She uproots all that is false. For that she is represented as a killer. Now all kinds of perversions follow. But these deities, there are higher deities and lower deities who trade in the name of the higher deities. Most of the Puranic deities are not the original Vedic or Tantric deities. They are called Uccha Devatas, what Sri Aurobindo calls the overmental gods. These are gods of the vital worlds, the lower vital worlds, even of the mental worlds. So to come back to the point, immense, implacable deities oppose an inert soul and a somnambulist force have made a world estranged from life and thought. This world, whatever it may have been in the beginning, it has been alienated from original life an original thought by two factors. One is an inert soul. The soul that is caught up in this universal movement is at present in an inert poise. It is in a kind of trance. It doesn't move by itself. It has to be driven. And the force that drives is not a conscious force. It is a somnambulist force. Somnambulist, you know, is one who walks in the sleep, unconscious, sleepwalker. That is, there is unconsciousness on one side and inertness on the other. Between these two, the world has been estranged, alienated from life, from the truth of life and the truth of thought. Moreover, the dragon of the dark foundations keeps unalterable the law of chance and death. Now, we know that there is a law operating in this material world. But to all appearance, it is a law of chance. Things happen as if from nowhere, unexpected, and everything ends in death. Now, this inexorable law of death and the unalterable law of chance, they are supported by a dark foundation, inconscient nations, where there is absolutely no consciousness, no light. It is insentience. The dragon of the dark foundations, dragon is a huge bird supporting it is an imagery. That means the dark being of this foundation keeps the law of chance and death unaltered. On his long way through time and circumstance, man's way, a long way, he has to tread a long way from the inconscience to the superconscious above. Through, and that passage is through time, the durations of the past, present and future, and circumstance, the compulsions of happenings, circumstances. On that way, he meets the grey-hued, riddling, nether shadow sphinx. This is an allusion to sphinx in the Egyptian mythology. You know, there are huge tracts of sands, deserts, and on some junction of roads, they speak of sphinx is a deity, half woman, half lion. The body is of a lion, the head is of a, upper part is of a woman. And in some describe it, that figure as having wings. Now that woman, across every traveler who passes by the road, she will ask a question. And if that fellow is unable to answer the question, as it was most of the times, she would kill him with her paw. And tradition has it that only one person answered her question. I don't remember the exact detail, but it was about death. And the question that the answer that was given was correct. And she herself immediately, when the question was given, jumped to her death. So that is this. Pardon? Who is it, sir?
King Oedipus.
Oedipus. And here the question was on death, isn't it, sir?
Who is it? Who starts with four legs, and continues with two legs, and ends with three legs. Man. He answered it.
Yes. As King Oedipus. And she jumped to her death. So this, he borrows that mythology and says, man, as he is traveling through his long way, the grey-hued, riddling, she always speaks in riddles, who confuses your intelligence. Nether shadow sphinx, her dreadful paws upon the swallowing sands, awaits him, armed with the soul-slaying word. Man is awaited by that sphinx, so that she can kill him. Across his path sits the dim camp of night, and ahead is the camp of night. He has to pass through a long stage of obscurity and darkness. That is his path, and his day is a moment in perpetual time. His day means a period of brightness, period of work, is only a moment in perpetual time. He is the prey of the minutes and the hours. So both ways, he is the sufferer. Each minute that passes, each hour that passes, sorrows him. His life gets shortened. He is the prey of the minutes and the hours. I think time is up. We should stop there.